Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordani. This is where we interview both seasoned and new authors from professions across the spectrum. With me today is a man who has had a very successful and interesting life. He tells the story in a book called A Summer Classic, The Bew White Story, an entrepreneur's tale of love, life, and business. Covers all three. He connected with writer Christopher Taunton to create the book. He founded the company Summer Classic. See what he did? The title and the book and everything. Very clever. I like it. Bew White, welcome to Book Spectrum.
Thank you, Chris. Well, great to be here.
Well, great to have you here. I want to talk about the company and everything, but what inspired you to tell the story of your life?
What really inspired me is I almost died. And, you know, it's a very similar story to It's a Wonderful Life, except I didn't try to kill myself. So I go to China a lot. I've been to China 29 times. And so when you're in the plane a long time, you tend to get blood clots. And I got blood clots in my lungs. And fortunately, I was in the hospital. And one stopped my heart, and my heart rate went to 30, where you're not pumping blood up into your head. And so you get a signal you're going to die. And I was like, okay, I'm dead. Just eternity awaits. And so I came back and I was like, what am I doing here? And I got a signal that said, you need to write the book. I had already started working on it, but I really got this strong feeling presence from God that I need. I mean, that sounds crazy to some people, I'm sure, but that I needed to write the book. So I started working on it myself, and I wasn't very good at writing. So I started interviewing writers and getting them to write a chapter for me, pay them, and they'd write a chapter. And I finally found this guy that I knew his father, who's a great writer, has written lots of books, and he said he'd help him edit it. So I worked with him for a year to get it published, and bingo, here we are.
I was going to save this for a little bit later in the interview, but you mentioned it already. The book, A Summer Classic's, not just about your success in the company. It's not only about your adventures in business and life, but you reveal your struggle with the blood clots in your lungs.
Mm-hmm.
What did that teach you? I know it gave you inspiration. What did it teach you about your life facing adversity and your overall outlook?
Really, the adversity part is all through the book. It's the adversity of starting a small business from scratch and then building it up to a relatively large company. We're sort of the luxury outdoor furniture company in the United States. And so I go through trials and tribulations, and a lot of it has to do with relationships. Certainly my relationship with my wife is critical, but I like to say I have an MBA in mistakes, and I'm working on my PhD. And so I go from making mistake to mistake to like figuring out what to do next and kind of grit through it. And so that has a lot to do with the theme, the throughput of the whole thing. But like I said, it's very similar to the Jimmy Stewart. In fact, I researched whether I could get the title It's a Wonderful Life, because there's no book called It's a Wonderful Life. So I said, okay, well, I should be able to get that. And my trademark lawyer said, no, that's not going to happen. So,
you don't really want that anyway. You want to make it your own story.
Exactly. Well, it is. Yeah, good point. It's a Wonderful Life, too.
I'm a James Stewart guy, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
I did like the story. My story is a little bit the opposite. Charlie came to me and said, everybody be better off without you, Chris. But I'm just... Bew White is with me on Book Spectrum. The book is A Summer Classic, The Bew White Story, an entrepreneur's tale of love, life, and business. The adversity you faced with the clots is a big one. But what about the smaller bits? I know you talked about that as well. You wrote about that. How does a businessman not get frustrated after failing so many times? And I'm one of those too. I run my own production company. It's not easy because there are the up times and the down times, and you have to work through all of those. How did you do it while designing furniture?
Well, there are six traits of an entrepreneur that are really critical. And I didn't come up with this myself, but a guy named Gino Wickman that did the EOS. I don't know if you're familiar with the Entrepreneurial Operating System, but that's a system that people use to run their companies. He wrote this book and I read it. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't even know if I have these traits. And he kind of starts with, if you don't have all six of these, you can't be an entrepreneur. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm already in. So, real quick, they're visionary, passionate, driven. This is a big one, risk taker. And that was the thing that really kind of, I used to put up my house every year for like 11 years, take all my equity out, take a home equity line out and put it in the company and then take it out. Cause we were seasonal. I would put it in and take it back out. And I kept going, man, am I ever going to quit having to do this? And eventually I did, but that was a critical part. Also being responsible as part of it and driven and a problem solver. So have that, you know, if you want to start your own business, I think those six traits are really critical.
Oh, they are important traits, I'll tell you that.
I don't know if you want to pursue that any further.
Well, upbringing also helps too. It depends on everybody's situation, but you wrote that your father was a huge inspiration to you. Tell us about him and the role he played in your life and, of course, gaining those six traits somehow as an entrepreneur.
Well, it kind of starts with me coming out of college and going to work for my great-grandfather's company, which was a Fortune 500 company. And then my friends and cousins came in after me, and I was like, man, this is going to be a bloodbath when I get to be, you know, 50 or so. And if I don't get to be president, I'll be disappointed. So I started thinking about what I could do. And I was calling on entrepreneurs, and one day I just said, "What? Do you mind telling me what you pay yourself?" And he told me, and he was paying himself more than the president of the company, this Fortune 500 company I was working for. I was like, man, that seems like a much better, easier, you know, and I could kind of start the thing back over again. That's kind of my ideas. A lot of people have made a lot of money off this company that didn't really do anything but sit at home and get dividends. And I would say I'd like to start that over for my great-grandchildren. And so my father was on the board of Avondale. This Avondale Mills was the name of the company that were in the textile business. And he and, you know, when I mentioned this to him, I thought he would go, no, don't do that. You have a great job. But he encouraged me because he worked with entrepreneurs. You know, he was on the board of like four Fortune 500 companies. But he knew entrepreneurs could really do well if they could, you know, succeed. So he encouraged me to do it and helped me find the company. And that was the beginning of my first mistake. I bought a company using 25% of my net worth, and it was a disaster. You know, it's like after 9 months, I had to quit. I was like, this is a company that's never going to make it. So, I went off on my own and started my own company.
The good thing is you got experience. And that's important because that worked with the next company.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
So you start up Summer Classics. What brought you into the outdoor furniture business?
Okay, well, the first company I started was called Vista Corporation, and it was a sales rep company. And I would go to, you know, companies in the furniture business and say, you know, I can help you with your sales. I can help you with product design. I can help you, you know, get salesmen and go see clients and blah, blah, blah. So, and some of them signed up for that. And I ended up taking a territory myself. And while I'm in that territory, I picked up an outdoor furniture line, and it became bigger than all my other lines combined. So I kind of pared back everything I was doing, and I worked on outdoor furniture. But I didn't really like what I was selling, and I didn't like anything anybody else made. I was going, God, I wonder if somebody would like what I like. And at the same time, I said, I'm a sales rep, and I was making great money. But I was like, I'm going 50,000 miles. I'm never at home. I have three kids. I've got to start something that's not so dependent on me. So I got on the, I got off the road a little bit and said, okay, I've set a goal of 40. By the time I'm 40, I'm getting off the road. So I started like eight different companies. And one of those was an outdoor furniture company making the stuff that I was saying that I like for myself that nobody else made. It's kind of a niche. It was painted wooden outdoor furniture. And that's how I started, and it worked, and it worked so well that one day my receptionist came in my office and said, "Mr. White, I answer the phone Vista Corporation, but every time I do, they say, 'Is this Summer Classics?'" So I said, "Well, when you go back to your desk, answer the phone Summer Classics." And I kind of went, "Okay, I'm going with this. This is what I know. It makes sense." And I dropped out of all the other businesses I'd gotten into.
How did you build Summer Classics to become a success amid what we have seen over the years in the outdoor furniture business as other companies have come and gone?
What was very interesting when I first started, I had great relationships with what we call the dealers. These were outdoor furniture stores. And they weren't really that interested in what I was doing. But the Williams-Sonomas, you know, the Pottery Barns, those kind of people, they owned a company called Garden Disease at the time, the Smith & Hawkins, the Front Gates, the Restoration Hardwares, the Crate & Barrels, those people were really interested in what I was doing because it was unique. And so I started selling them. And then as I grew and they grew, they started to ask me not to put my name on the furniture, to put their name. I was like, okay, I'm going to be able to build a brand with these guys. So I've got to start my own stores. So I started doing my own stores. I started designing my own fabric because fabric became a really critical part of the outdoor furniture business. We managed to double every 3.5 years. So if you can imagine, and sort of some financing it out of my own pocket. So it was very difficult to grow. You know, you can grow yourself out of business. And you're certainly seeing that with the people like Peloton and these big companies that they talk about cash burn. You know, if I'm burning cash, I'm burning my own cash. I didn't have outside investors to put more money in. So I was constantly looking for money. So I was always expanding my credit line at the banks. And so, and this is a critical part of the book, is how we dealt with 2008, which was the Great Recession, as everybody remembers. I had already gone to Royal Bank of Scotland, which at the time was the largest bank in the world, RBS. And I had gotten a line for $20 million. And they kind of let me write my own ticket. And I was like, this is awesome. And I got off all my personal guarantees. I didn't have to put any money in the company anymore. And I was on my way to growing the company to over $100 million. And so I'm almost there. I'm like approaching it. And then 2008 hits and I'm going like, oh, wow. So we shrank 30%. All of a sudden, the bank decides they don't like me and they start squeezing me. And I'm going like, I'm going to go out of business. And then they called me and said, okay, you've got 3 weeks and we're going to take $2.5 million out of your bank account. I was like, oh my God, what can I do? And we're going to shrink your line, you know, your credit line down and not give you as much as we had. I had borrowed all the money. I was at $19.88 million. I was like, oh my goodness. We were having a great, you know, we were growing.
Right.
So I ended up, I was prayed about it every night. And I was like, I can't figure this out on my own. I got to have some wisdom come somewhere. And then I came up with, okay, call your vendors. So I started calling my largest vendor and saying, I don't know what to do. I can't figure out what to do. The bank is squeezing me. And he said, well, just don't pay me. I went like, ever? It's like, no, just pay me when you can, you know. And so how long? 180 days. How much? $2 million. So I was like, okay, thank you. Wow. So then I started calling all my vendors and I ended up getting, you know, close to $10 million calling my vendors and saying, how much will you give me? Or extend my terms 90 to 180 days. And then if you can't pay, then call me and we'll work with you because we believe in you. And I was like, it speaks to the building of relationships, you know, with your vendor relationships. Obviously my relationship with my wife is really important because she was kept saying, you can do it. You can do it. Even when I didn't believe in myself. And then of course your family, I've got two of my family members, my son and daughter are in the company. And so I think that relationships, obviously the relationship with my employees as well was really critical to get them to, you know, hang on with me.
Well, it's good to have your loyal employees and your family working with you. How did you keep Summer Classics up with the new styles over the many years, the changing customer needs, competition, and the constantly changing way retail stores do business?
I think we have, I call it the je ne sais quoi, whatever it is, something that smells the marketplace. It's an instinct of what the consumer wants before they know they want it. Sometimes we're too early, you know, we're coming out stuff that didn't sell, and then it's that whole look about 3 or 4 years later becomes really hot. And we're like, okay, I guess we should have left that in the line.
or held it off for a couple of years.
Yeah, I know. We held it. Well, we thought it was good. And okay, well, that didn't sell. Let's drop it. And then boom. I was like, oh my goodness. That was exactly what we had. So we see a lot of that happening. So it's just staying in front of the market. And I call it moving the peanut. In other words, when everybody starts copying you, I'm really getting copied now because we've grown so much. I have to move the peanut. In other words, change the product line so dramatically and they won't know if it's going to sell or not. And it's too risky for them to copy it until I start selling it. And once you start selling it, you pretty much have your market share, and it's very difficult, even for a lower price, to get people to change. So it's very fashion-oriented, so you're right about that. It's incredibly fashion-oriented. That said, I thought product life cycle would be 4 to 6 years. And yet we have product that's been in line 20 years. We're dying to drop it. But we're like, it's still selling so much. We're like, I don't think we can drop this. It's like the volume's too big, you know?
And everybody wants something else. A long time ago, it was just about tables, chairs, and umbrellas. I remember that back in my days working retail.
Right.
This has changed over the years, Bu. We now see outdoor bars, outdoor removable fire pits, outdoor lounges. What's next? Outdoor offices or outdoor soundproof podcast studios? That might be fun. I could go with that. Has to be waterproof, though, I guess.
I'm going to come out with air conditioning, outdoor air conditioning.
Yeah, oh, that's good. That would be nice.
It's so hot in the South. I guess you're in New York. Are you in New York?
Yeah, we're in New York, so it sometimes gets hot up here.
Yeah, I used to live there. I mean, that's where when I started in the textile business, I moved to New York City. And one of the things that happened when I was there is nobody was calling Ralph Lauren. I mean, he just started, and I started calling on him. And I was fascinated because we were working with cut and sew companies like Levi Strauss and Wrangler and H.D. Lee. Those were our big clients, or people that made slacks or jeans. And so when I called on him, I was like, how does this work? And he says, well, we put our logo on there and we designed the product. And then we have other people make everything for us. And we can move wherever, if we smell the market. It's kind of what we were talking about before. If we smell the market, we can move in that direction. We can even be in women's wear or cosmetics. Or I was like, wow, that's a great model. And I started thinking, if I ever start a business, that's how I want to do it. Because you're not locked into what the factory makes, you know, and then you're trying to sell stuff people don't want.
There you go. And of course, Ralph Lauren's a good guy to talk to, even though Kramer tried to sell him the cologne that smells like, or the perfume that smells like the ocean. That's what it was on Seinfeld.
Okay. Jim Cramer, is that you talking about? CNBC Cramer?
You know, he's like, no, Kramer on Seinfeld.
Kramer on Seinfeld.
Jim Cramer. Jim Cramer always has good ideas.
Yeah, he has a lot of ideas, that's for sure.
The book, A Summer Classic, once again, Bu, and again, it's not just about the success in your company. I do have fun talking about that. It's also about how you recovered from the clots in your lungs. Normally, I'd ask what one piece of advice would be for those starting out in their career that you might have, but I want to ask this question because your life, your business is going really well. So,
yes,
what one piece
it's
of advice?
We're at the tipping point. Where things are just going to grow 30-something% this year.
But right when things were going really well at one point, the early 2010s, that's when you had the health issue. What one piece of advice would you give to a successful entrepreneur or somebody on their way to success who is facing a health crisis and wants to not only get back into the swing and recover, but also wants to kind of balance their life a little better?
Well, if it's a health crisis, I mean, it depends on the health crisis. If you've been given 5 months to live, I say, you know, I'll quit work pretty quick and start. Yeah, this is really interesting. I just was working with a guy that had done a study on regrets in life. And you had to be 90 years old to interview for this. And he came up with three things. But the big one was what they said, the biggest regret they had was they didn't take enough risk. And I was like going, well, that's not more. I think I took too many risks. I was like betting the house every year, you know. And I look at some of the stuff that Elon Musk did on SpaceX, where he's putting up $100 million and it doesn't work. And he's like, okay, well, let's just keep going. I was like, wow.
Hey, it works for him.
I'm a risk taker. Yeah, exactly. And we need more people like that. I think it's critical to take risks. I think if you're going to look back on your life, I would say that would be it. And I'd say anyone that's getting into business, this is something I learned the hard way. Because I started losing money, I was like, I've got to learn how to read the financial statements. I mean, I had the financial statements because I had to have them for the bank, but I just didn't understand what was going on. And understanding and reading a financial statement and having an intuitive feel for the business in a pretty quick, you know, go through it. I would sleep with them at night, you know, and I was like, okay, I got to figure this thing out. What am I doing wrong? and then we're kind of fix it. And so I think reading, being able to read a financial statement, which a lot of people can't do. I certainly couldn't when I started. I could sell, you know, but I couldn't. And I was outselling my, outkicking my coverage, as I say. But I've learned how to read a financial statement. I think that was a critical part. And then I also came up with this mantra, never run out of money. So I was always looking for banks, and I was always trying to increase my credit line. Even if I didn't need it, I knew that I was going to grow into it. And I had been getting kicked out of banks because I outgrew their ability to lend to me. You know, they have these thresholds that they can lend, which are, it's generally like 2 million, 5 million, 10 million, 20 million. And then if they can lend over 20, you get stepped up to somebody you don't know. And you're like trying to explain your business model to somebody, and you get like an hour, and if you don't do it right, then nah, we're not going to do that. You know, it's like, ooh.
Yeah. That's the brick wall.
Yes, the proverbial brick wall, exactly.
Bill White, thank you very much for being with us on Book Spectrum.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
The book is a summer classic, The Bill White Story. You can pick it up on digital outlets, and there's a link to it on our website, Book Spectrum. Once again, I'm Chris Cordani, your host. Thank you for listening to Book Spectrum.